Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thanks so much for joining us here on the program. You know that we come your way every Sunday at 7 a.m., 7 p.m., and 1 a.m. Monday mornings. We also stream live at richarddugan.com. We archive these programs at richarddugan.com, the radio show's page. We link to our guests. And also a reminder that what you hear on the radio is only, in some cases, a small portion, by two-thirds maybe, of the actual full interview. There's what's called the afterview, what you don't hear after the interview goes off the air on the radio. And we encourage you to go to the website, the radio show's page, and listen to it in its entirety. In some instances, I've gone an hour and a half with my guests. And it's been quite exciting to be able to do that and give you something special. But it also gives us an opportunity to go more in depth on our conversation about the given subject that we bring to you each week. Well, today is, I think, going to be a fun day because we're going to be delving into an area that I think either is or will be, maybe once was, a part of the evolutionary process, a normal day-to-day aspects of our lives. We're going to be dealing with the subject of telepathy, but specifically spiritual telepathy, ancient techniques to access the wisdom of your soul. My guest, Colleen Morrow, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And I have often thought about telepathy, and we're going to get into the specifics of spiritual telepathy, and maybe it's all the same thing. We'll find out. But I've often thought that what telepathy is, since it isn't words, is more along the lines, and it's clearer, with images that or sensations, feelings, maybe even emotions that we will transmit one to the other. And our telepathic communication with one another, as well as, I think in this case, with our higher self, with the divine, with the universe, is so much clearer because, as they say, so much is lost in translation when you translate. It is said that truth is only truth until it's written down. And then the meaning, the context, the total aspect is lost. I'm reading Stranger in a Strange Land, and there's a phrase that's used, a word. It's called grokking, to grok something. And I think with telepathy, we will be able to assimilate all of that into every atom of our being and share that with other people, and there'll be no misunderstanding. Is that right? Wrong? Is that a fair assessment? Is it partially? What's your take on that as we get started?
I think it's all true. It's all true. There's different types of telepathy, and we perceive at different levels. Do you want me to talk about the three types?
Please. I know that we're talking about spiritual telepathy, but what else is there?
Well, there's three types. The lowest is instinctual or feeling-based telepathy. And we share this type of telepathy with the animal kingdom, and it's still used as a means of communication in indigenous cultures. And what you said about feelings is perfect because it's said to be strongest with the people that we're close to. Mm-hmm. Rupert Sheldrake has done a lot of experiments with this, and he also calls this, he's a scientist, and he calls this instinctual. He says it's part of our evolutionary heritage and part of our biological animal nature, which I totally agree with. And all his research and experiments have shown that it's strongest with the people that we're close to. And what I did with this book is I studied esoteric material, and then I looked for ways to confirm with science and with other traditions. And so it was very interesting to do this because I found the parallels everywhere. So the first is instinctual. The second is mental or mind-to-mind telepathy. And a lot of what is studied scientifically as mental telepathy really belongs to the first. It's instinctual telepathy or clairvoyance. And the scientists often talk about how hard it is to tease the two apart. And I think that's why, because it's really an earlier type of telepathy. Each type of telepathy or perception really indicates another step up the evolutionary ladder. The real mental telepathy is very advanced and not very common. Alice Bailey says that it'll be the preferred mode of communication in about 300 years. And good examples are Alice Bailey's work and Helena Blavatsky's work, Helena Roerich's work. What they were able to do is they were able to attune their minds remotely with another person's mind, and they wrote down information that led to their books. So that's true mental telepathy, and that's coming. The next type of telepathy, and the highest type of telepathy, is spiritual telepathy, and that's soul-to-soul telepathy. And that allows us to make contact with higher beings and people that are on the earth too from a soul-to-soul level. And it said that that experience led to the transmission of our great spiritual literature, the Bible, the Quran, and so on, that it was transmitted in exactly that way. But what's interesting to me is that this is happening right now, sort of in addition to the mental, we're starting to develop the spiritual as well. And it also was interesting to me as when I learned about how this relates to the chakra system, that the first type of telepathy, instinctual, utilizes the third chakra. Mental telepathy utilizes the fifth or throat chakra. And the highest, spiritual telepathy, utilizes the head centers, the two head centers. Well, so it's an evolutionary step each way. And it's a way to look at how our perceptual abilities change from the instinct of early man to the intellect of modern man to the pure intuitive knowing of the future man. And we're right at that doorway.
Okay, so let's look at the first form of telepathy, that instinctual, that according to this one gentleman you referenced, you know, it's just part of, I don't know if it's incorporated, for example, in the DNA that is transferred from one person to another as we procreate. But it seems to me like, and it's just my observation here, that it's telepathy is so much, it's an internal process. It's more of an intangible process that you can't really define where it's coming from. You know, you talk about, everybody wants to try to figure out, well, where's the mind? Is it in the brain? Where's the heart? Is it, you know, the heart of an individual, not so much the physical heart, and so on and so forth. That it seems to me that they're regardless of the levels that you're talking about, that somehow, from my perspective, they're all sort of, they come with us when we come into the body. I don't know what your perspective is on spirituality and we're spiritual beings having a human experience, or has this been defined? Has it been, is there a certain level of definitive evidence to show that this is part of the biochemical makeup, that's where that comes from? Or is it something we bring with us into this world, into this dimension, this realm, into this body?
Well, I think we're all evolving lifetime to lifetime. And as we do, we develop higher sense apparatus, a more subtle perceptual ability.
Okay.
And the first type of telepathy, again, is that instinctive telepathy, and it really helped early man to sense danger. And when we develop the next higher type of perception, the older way doesn't disappear. It just goes below the threshold of our conscious awareness. That's why people talk about their gut feelings. You know, they make a decision with their head, but then their gut's telling them something different. So there's this information stream that's going on kind of unconsciously. And here's what's really interesting. Again, because this information is very esoteric, I looked for ways to validate it. And I read in this esoteric literature that instinctive telepathy utilizes the third chakra, like I said. So I thought, okay, how am I going to validate this? So then I, and it's feeling based. So then I read Rupert Sheldrake's books and I find that he's basically saying the same things. And then I started looking at other teachings and I found something really interesting and I got really fascinated and just spent years studying this stuff. The kahunas, for example, the native priests of Hawaii, talk about telepathy as an exchange from one solar plexus to another, that there's an etheric cord that goes from one person to the other, and it gets stronger and stronger the more you communicate this way. And then the African Bushmen say something very similar, that everybody's connected with a line of energy that extends from one belly button to another. And the Aboriginals talk about their miwi, which is in the pit of their stomach. And they say that the miwi is what allows them to see or hear at a distance. And then the Japanese talk about herigi, which translates as belly talk, the art of the belly, basically. And it's how they get an intuitive take on someone or some proposal. It's very valued in the business community. And then we talk about gut feelings.
Yeah.
So I thought, this is really interesting. They're all talking about the same type of the body, same place in the body, the stomach, you know, the solar plexus area. So it was an interesting way to kind of validate this esoteric teaching that it's utilizes that particular area. And so they're saying that over and over. And we talk about gut feelings.
So the evolutionary process of telepathy is, in a manner of speaking, from what I'm getting from what you're saying, is that we're moving, using the example of the chakras, we're moving up, shall we say, the chakra ladder.
Correct.
As we go lifetime to lifetime, if in fact that is indeed what happens, we become more. And I'm curious, telepathy and intuition, what's the relationship? Are they the same?
Well, that's a good question. And you know that I published Intuition Magazine.
Mm-hmm. I was going to ask you about that. Yes.
And I could tell you the story about how that happened. And I actually had an experience of spiritual telepathy. And I see spiritual telepathy as the next step, a more advanced form of spiritual perception. And some people call it the higher correspondence to our personal intuition. Our personal intuition gives us guidance about our relationships and our day-to-day lives, but spiritual telepathy allows us to make contact with the soul, and the soul knows our higher purpose. It's been with us lifetime after lifetime. It helps us understand the bigger picture, and it is our highest and most reliable form of direction and guidance. We can trust it when we make that contact.
So the soul. When you say contact with our soul, you're talking about our individual soul, my soul, your soul. That's what I'm going to be contacting is mine, not yours, but mine, right?
That's right. That essential essence, that part of us that's been with us through all our lifetimes and that throws down a little piece of itself into the physical world so that we are spiritual beings having a human experience and that we learn and grow and develop the qualities we need while we're on Earth.
So, but while we are here on Earth, we have layer upon layer of, I'll call them masks, the id, the ego, the superego, or whatever other terms you want to use for all of the different parts of our personality, our beingness, if you will, and that the soul is at the core, and it takes us time to work our way down to that core by working our way up that chakric ladder, if you will.
That's right. And in this, there's meditations that allow us to strengthen our connection to the soul. And in these meditations, we visualize the soul as a star about 6 inches above our head. So we're working our way up. The soul has awareness of us, but we don't have direct awareness of it until we make that connection.
Okay.
And we work our way back up.
Let me ask you a quick question. I'm going to give you an example of something that happened to me. And I because I'm not sure if it was the universe speaking to me telepathically, or if I was picking up on something on the gut level. I was bicycling when I used to do that to and from work. It was a 10-mile bike ride each way, and it was along farm fields. This was in the western part of Phoenix, and I worked in what we used to call the South 40, which was not too far off. Not anymore because they've really built it up. But I was bicycling, and I was the intersections were between farm fields, and I got this impression that okay, at the next corner, you need to turn right, go up to the next corner, turn left, then go to that corner intersection, turn left again to get back on the road you were on, and then continue on your way. I went half a mile down the main road I was already on. The impression just kept coming, would not go away. I eventually turned around, went back that half mile to that intersection. I made all of the necessary turns as instructed prior, and then continued on my way. I have no idea why. All I know was I had to do it. I don't know why I had to do it, but I did, and I did that. And I don't know what I avoided. I don't know what chain of events I averted or started in motion, or if it was a test of trust. Are you serious? You're going to listen to your intuition, but you're not going to follow its promptings, kind of thing.
That's really interesting. Maybe there would have been a truck barreling through with his brakes broken or something. You don't know.
Yeah.
I think that's a really interesting story.
But where does that fall? I mean, where am I getting that information from? I mean, and I know you can't answer definitively. I'm not asking that. But as an example of us getting those kinds of impressions, and they get stronger and stronger until you follow through and then they go away. Do you have any idea where that kind of thing comes from? Is that telepathy from the divine, maybe?
Could be an instinctual sense of that there's danger that you have to avoid.
Okay.
It's hard to tease it apart.
Yeah. Okay. Well, now, before we get into the aspects of Intuition Magazine, I want to ask how you got started. What was it? What was the catalyst, if there was a single catalyst, or maybe there were multiples, that you wanted to find out about all of this and deal with not only telepathy, but a bunch of other types of aspects of untapped power of I don't want to just exclusively say the mind, but of maybe the human experience.
Well, I'll tell you the story about how the magazine got started. That's a great illustration of what I'm teaching now. I had always been interested in the spiritual world and intuitive studies. And in the late 80s, I was living in San Francisco, and I had worked for several alternative magazines, and I suddenly was without a job and wasn't sure what to do. I'd already worked for all the magazines that I liked. And I was running out of money and really anxious about finding another job and talking to editors and researching new magazines and really driving myself crazy, wondering what was going to happen. You know, it's so expensive to live there and you have to have a job. And one morning I woke up, I decided that I needed to give myself a mental health day, that I was going to give myself one 24-hour period where I didn't think about the fact that I was unemployed and running out of money. I was just going to enjoy the day. And I remember it was October. That's my favorite month in San Francisco. I went out and bought some bulbs, and I was just puttering around in my back garden when I had a type of intuitive experience that I'd never had before. I have always been very intuitive, but I always access intuition through feelings or body-based feelings, sensations or feelings, like a queasy stomach or something. But I had this thought just flash through my mind, and the thought was the Center for Applied Intuition. And it felt like the words were just dropped right into my brain. I immediately knew that it wasn't my thought. But even so, I stood there and tried to trace back why I would have had that thought, and it didn't make any sense. I was looking for a magazine job, and I knew about the center, and I had met the founder, and I couldn't imagine why I would go there, why I would be guided to go there. It didn't make any sense. I knew he had a little two-room office, and he ran intuition trainings and so on. And so I mulled it over for a few days, and then I thought, well, what have I got to lose? And I called him up, and I asked him to send me information about the center's activities. And a few days later, I got a big package. There were a lot of brochures and a very simple typewritten journal called Applied Psi. And it was a little magazine about intuition and creativity. And I was flipping through the pages and thinking, this is really interesting. This could be a real magazine. I knew he sent it only to the center's 200 or so members. And I thought, you know, I think a lot of people would be interested in this. We'd have to change the name and spiff it up. It was very, you know, very primitive. And so I called him up and asked to come talk to him. And when I went over and pitched my idea, he just lit up and said that he had always dreamed of turning Applied Psi into a real magazine, but the right person had never come along. So I went home and I created a proposal, and I came back the next day, and I was suddenly launching a new magazine. And we called it Intuition, a Magazine for the Higher Potential of the Mind. And I got two issues out for the center before he closed it, and then he signed the rights over to me. And I later got a grant and set up an office. And I ran the magazine for about 10 years. And then I started to study the Ageless Wisdom. And I came across the subject of spiritual telepathy. And I realized instantly that this was the next step. This was the higher piece of what we had taught with the magazine. We had taught the basic intuition development material. And we really helped people get in touch, reacquainted with that other way of knowing, that gut feeling that we learned to discount as the mind became the essential tool to figure things out. And so spiritual telepathy was really a step up. And so I spent years studying this because I felt like it was important and it just felt like something I was supposed to do, that it really was the next step.
Now, interesting, you use the same term that I have been acquainted with, ancient wisdom teachings. And I've been studying since I was 17, which makes it, what, 30 years, something like that, 40 years. And I am always fascinated by people's perspectives and observations of the various writings that are out there, but even more so of the writings that they don't want us to read, that were kept out of the canon, regardless of what the philosophy happens to be, whether it's Christianity or Buddhism or Islam or whatever the case, or Judaism, what have you. I've always found that fascinating. And also that people are, within these different philosophies, they all have a different take, that in spite of what you're told from, say, the pulpit or the front of the temple or what have you, that everybody believes the same thing, my experience is not everybody believes the same thing. And they kind of keep it to themselves most of the time because they want to continue to practice in these places and so forth. But I'm noticing, too, that people are beginning to step out, shall we say, step outside the nine dots and start to investigate for themselves. And it sounds to me like you have done the same thing. What was your, shall we call it, traditional religious spiritual upbringing?
Catholic. And I had moved away from it many, many years ago. I think I was 14. And it suddenly dawned on me that as a female, I was sort of valued only for my ability to produce life. I had read about women who have pregnancies that were going to kill them. The mother's always sacrificed for the baby. And I remember thinking, I don't think so. There has to be something different than this for me. And, in my late teens and 20s, I investigated all the Eastern traditions because I was really longing for that sense of communion that you do not get in organized religions. Mm-hmm. But then after years, I stumbled across esoteric Christianity and I realized that I was home, that there really was a contemplative tradition in our own religion that was gutted early on, but it was there. Mm-hmm. And so I started studying that and that's really been my practice ever since.
I was 16. And I delivered newspapers, and Sunday mornings I delivered the big papers to my 100-plus customers. I come home, get back into bed around 7:30, 8 o'clock, I tap on the door, 9:30, hey, Richard, time to get up to go to Mass. I don't want to go. My mother says, okay. And years later, I asked her why she did that. She says, because I didn't want you to push away from the church. Mm. And now that's where she was then. She isn't there now. She's got a much broader perspective. The conversations we have are like what you and I are talking about, and it's really very cool. But I never did push away. I just moved on to other things, but I still have a great love for the ritual, the tradition, the ceremony, the symbols, and all of those things. They're all a wonderful thing. I even had a great experience through my first wife. Her family was of the Byzantine rite of the Catholic Church, which a lot of people think is Orthodox. But I even have one of the books of the liturgy that's done in Slavonic, and even much more symbolism and ritual and ceremony and tradition and so forth, cantors singing in the background and all of this kind of stuff. And then on warm spring days, they have to open the windows up because if they don't, the incense and the heat will cause people to pass out in this small church that they had. But I've always been intrigued by that. And then, of course, when even before this, but when Dan Brown came out with his books on, that tied in all of the whether they are mythological or not, aspects of the Catholic Church and the Knights Templar and all of those types of different things, I was even more intriguing. Yet I also knew there had to be more. And I began to search. And I actually went through the Eastern door at the age of 17. My metaphysical primer was Autobiography of a Yogi, which I now have an audio book and I've listened to it dozens of times just in the last few years. And it's just fascinating to me where people are coming from And it shows me that other people are—they're doing the same kind of searching. And I'm wondering—you talked—you talked about—you mentioned the studies and well, the other philosophies around the world talking about this cord that ties us together.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that as we as individuals start to realize that the material world isn't where it's at, in spite of what you'd hear in the '60s about kids graduating from high school and not going to college because they were going to travel to go find themselves. And that it was the inner life, not the outer, that made all the difference. And when we start seeing that, people start looking into things of this nature. And that's what I find so fascinating.
Yeah, I think that's true. And, you know, it's funny. When I was going to church, I had that same feeling, this thrill, just the pageantry and seeing the bishops come down the aisle. That was the best part for me. There's something old in us, I think, that really responds to that.
Yeah, I that's why I like watching a lot of the films and television programs that take place in the medieval times, in mm-hmm. the days of King Arthur and with Merlin the Magician and so on and so forth, or even some of these television programs that focus on the British royalty, but we're talking the 15, 16, 1700s, you know, and that whole thing, because the clothes, if, again, they must be accurate because we've got clothing that goes back that far, the clothes that they wore were just unbelievable, and the hairstyles and all of these different things were just, it's like, wow, who are you dressing up for? Well, you know, this is what they did, and that was part of the royal life in that case, and the church was the same way. That was a sort of a form of royalty. They had their own kingdom and the kingdom of God and so forth. I want to ask you about, I mean, we've sort of described our evolutionary process, and I asked this question of one of my guests. So do you see our evolutionary process as beginning to realize who we really are? And they said no. They said our evolutionary process will reach a level where we will begin to know who we have always been.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was really neat. What are your thoughts on that in conjunction with this spiritual telepathy and our evolutionary process?
Well, I totally agree. It's when we start to sort of walk the path of return, as it's called, and make direct contact with the soul. And again, the soul works from a higher point down. And at some point, we work from that lower point back up. And the reason I think this work is so essential right now, and the reason I spent so much time studying it, is because I do think that it's an evolutionary step, that when we contact the soul, we're taking our first steps into the subtle world. And it's then that we cross the boundary from human to superhuman development. And the subtle world then becomes part of our human world. And I do think that this is a really important step, especially now, because this contact with the soul allows us to realize that we're interconnected with everyone and everything. And I think it's that perspective that's really going to start to shift things when there's a critical mass of people taking that step, and that we have problems in the world now that can't really be solved in any other way, and we're kind of forced to do it. And Barbara Marx Hubbard and Eckhart Tolle and other people talk about this as a step that happens only through crisis, that we're forced into doing it, essentially. Eckhart Tolle has this great paragraph in one of his books, I think it's The New Earth, where he talks about an amphibian who's forced to live on the ground after its habitat dries up. And so the same thing's happening to us. We're being forced to a higher level of perception and understanding because we're faced with so many huge problems that we can't solve in any other way.
And that's one of the aspects of our existence that every one of us gets trapped in some from time to time. I mean, there was a time in 2015 into 2016 where I just honestly, I didn't care about what was going on politically. I just didn't care. Mm-hmm. And I had too many other things going on at work and with the radio program and at home with the different things. I didn't want to get sucked into that. And unfortunately, in September of 2016, and I can't even remember what it was, I got sucked into that vortex. And it took me 6 months to get out. I had to remind myself that this isn't real. I mean, maybe in the material world it's real, but not to me. It's not relevant because we're here for less than a puff of smoke a time. And in 100 years, 1,000 years, 10,000 years, none of what's going on right now is going to matter. It's irrelevant to what's going on within.
Mm-hmm.
And that may sound strange. Someone may say, well, yeah, but even 100,000, 10,000 years, what difference is it going to make what you do on the inside? You know what? From my perspective, the way the universe flows and the way things move and who knows what's going to collide with us. I love that one new program called Salvation where a comet or a meteor is headed for Earth and it's an instinctual event, an event of that could wipe out, you know, half the population or 95% of it. And I'm thinking, and the universe doesn't, it's not that the universe doesn't care. That's just the ebb and flow of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason, I don't know about you, Colleen, there's something in me that says that my life, my existence now does have meaning. Because if I didn't have that sense inside, and again, we could talk about where that comes from, then I could go out and I could rape and pillage and plunder, and because it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. This is all an accident. This is all irrelevant, and it doesn't matter what we do. But I there's that, whether it's from the gut, whether it's from the heart, whether it's from the higher self, I'm not sure. All I know is it's there. What about you?
Absolutely. I think that this is a really crucial time in our history, and I think a lot of us incarnated for the purpose of being a part of this and mm-hmm. helping. And I think that's what happened to me in the garden. I got orders from headquarters somehow. And I don't know if it was from the soul or from a higher level. And this is something that I haven't touched on yet. But when we connect with the soul, we actually have the ability to extend our attention even higher to the universal or divine mind. And the esoteric teachings tell us that there are higher beings that guide the evolution of our planet. And they can't physically affect life on Earth. They have to work through us. And so they look for people who have that connection with the soul. And when you have that, essentially it's a pipeline down to the brain. They can throw ideas down into your brain where they become conscious.
Mm-hmm.
And, oh, yeah, I think I'll go talk to this guy. And, hey, look, I could never have imagined that this would lead to my next job, but here it is.
Yeah.
And so we get called on to do our part, to do our service. And I think all of us who are doing this sort of thing are really operating under that kind of guidance, whether we know it or not. And I had a reading years ago, and this person said, you know, you didn't fall into your work by accident, that, you know, you've been working in step by step, learning the ropes and magazines and media and how to commute to how to communicate to a mass audience. And it wasn't an accident, you know, and it was just a spark in me from the time I was a kid that I wanted to do this kind of work. And so we, early on, you know, we have this sort of guidance, this sort of momentum that propels us forward.
Yeah. You know, it's also interesting, too. I have struggled with the concept of dualism, struggled with it because it's perplexing to me, based upon the ancient wisdom teachings that tell us where we come from and where we're going to, the one, that we come here. And there is duality, but where we came from and where we're going to, there is no duality. It just is. It is what it is. So I start looking at the material world, and people can label things as good, bad, good and evil, white, black and white, etc., etc. And yet, if I were to look at nature, which to me is the greatest teacher of all, there is no dualism. It just is what it is. Now, some will, again, but it's we who put, we place the judgment, if you will, and the label of good and bad, especially, for example, if we see certain animals pursuing other animals for food. Oh, that's terrible. What happened to the gazelle? Oh, that was awful what the lion did. This is what they do. That's how they live. That's they don't see it as good or bad. They just see it as that's their life. And if you go out into the universe and you see the planets moving around, you see comets flying here and there and meteors and this and that and the other, and stuff collides, that's neither good nor bad. That just is. That's the natural movement and forward motion, if you will, of the universe. And so now I'm wondering, from your perspective, how you have do you grapple with that in terms of our existence here in this brief puff of smoke, if you will, as I call it, of time that you know, because you used that wonderful. I loved what you said there about this calling that we get, and we never know what steps we're taking and where they're going to lead, but we just kind of follow them. And that's neither good nor bad. That's just, you know, it's like following a roadmap. There's nothing right or wrong or dualistic about it. I'm just following a roadmap.
Yeah, I see what you mean. For me, it's like such a deep pleasure to feel like I'm doing my part and that I'm doing utilizing all my skills and doing something that can make a difference in the world. To me, it's the best feeling, and I really devoted my life to it mm-hmm. because it gives me so much joy and because I can see that it is making a difference. And it's interesting that if I had all kinds of really wonderful, unexpected, synchronistic things happen. For example, the magazine really kind of started this whole trend towards intuitive awakening. And if you're willing to do something, if you're given an assignment, so to speak, and you're willing to do it, you're sort of the arms and legs of God, and you get the help you need.
Yeah.
I had a multimillionaire give me money that allowed me to get out of my dining room. I mean, that's where I was running the magazine, and have an office and hire a staff. The money just came. Mm-hmm. What I needed just came, and the right people just came. So I see it as just opening ourselves to the divine and making ourselves available for service.
You know, I, from a religious standpoint, and I struggle with a lot of these kinds of what I like to call heretical questions. I joke with people. I worked for 15 years at a Christian radio station and said that if they tattooed or burned a big letter H on my forehead, I'd wear it proudly because I just didn't buy into the party line, as I would call it. And one of the things that I came to the conclusion of, someone asked me about, you know, are you ready for Judgment Day? Are you saved? Da, 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 da. I said, well, you know what? I am. I am. Where I was and I am today is still my position, and that is that if indeed there is a day of judgment and I'm standing before God, and he asks me, could be she, we don't know, why should I let you into heaven? My basic response would be, you know, I did the very best with the life that you gave me. And you're going to do with me what you will. I mean, I have no control over that at this point. It's my life is over. It's done. And so it's entirely up to you. However, you created me and all of the other people on the planet. And again, we did all of the things the best we could. The bottom line, though, is it's all on you. You're the one that set all this in motion. So on the one hand, I take full responsibility for my life because I did the best I could with it. But in the grand scheme of things, you got this all rolling. So this is on you. And I'd walk away because what am I going to do? I can't fight God. And I think about that in terms of, for example, the devil and all of the representations in all of the ancient wisdom teachings about evil and so forth. And if God created everything, well, you know, it's kind of like, you ever seen the games, the little game, it's called pachinko, or the other type of game where you drop a ball from the top and it drops down through all of these pegs and what have you, but you don't know where the ball's going to go?
Mm-hmm.
That, to me, is basically the analogy of God. He dropped the ball down the slot, and where it goes, supposedly, he knows, and it's going to land at the bottom where it's going to land. But he started the ball rolling. You know, I say I keep using the pronoun he. And that's kind of the way I see things as far as we've been given this life. How we got here in terms of who gave it to us, I don't know, but here we are. And it's up to us to do something with the life we've been given, you know, and not just, you know, I suppose people could putter it away. That's their choice, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
And you never know what they're learning. They have a different task than we do.
A very good point. You and I've used the analogy of the Borg from Star Trek as the spiritual equivalency, but not in a malevolent way, just in a structural way, that they're all individuals coming from every corner of the universe, and they're all connected, getting information from the central voice, what have you, to carry out their individual tasks that are part of the big picture. Well, how different is that from our spiritual connection?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One thing I was really thrilled to discover when I was researching this book, and again, I took very esoteric material, digested it, and then tried to figure out how to make this accessible to a wider audience, the people who weren't already reading this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so it always begs the question, how do you know this any of this stuff is true?
Yeah.
And so I looked to see how I could validate it. And as I talked earlier, I looked to science and I looked to other cultures. And I also started studying different spiritual teachings, sort of the, and I didn't have a background in world religion, so I really had to hit the books. But one thing I discovered is that at its very core, the teaching is the same in every spiritual tradition. And so I illustrate that in the book as a way to kind of shore up this teaching where you don't know if it's true, but if it's being taught over and over in the same form in all these different traditions, then it's hard to dismiss it, even though it's very esoteric. So that was really a wonderful discovery for me, something I didn't know before.
That's very cool. We're talking with Colleen Morrow. She is the author of Spiritual Telepathy, Ancient Techniques to Access the Wisdom of Your Soul. Website, folks, the website is spiritualtelepathy.net. We will be linked to spiritualtelepathy.net as well so that you can get more information. We're going to continue our conversation here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We're giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Please stay tuned.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, and we are talking with Colleen Morrow, and she is the author of Spiritual Telepathy, Ancient Techniques to Access the Wisdom of Your Soul. SpiritualTelepathy.net is her website, and we encourage you to go to her website to do further research. I find it interesting, too, that you threw in science there, which I thought was rather interesting. Not that that's a good or bad necessarily, but I know that a lot of people have problems with science because, and this is sort of my analogy of the scientific community, and that is that we seem to think as human beings, the scientific community will do research and they'll. Let's just say for the sake of argument that there are 1,000 rules, scientific rules of the universe, and we've discovered 10 thinking that we know them all. And then in the next couple of years, we find number 11 and then we say, oh, we know it all now. And I sit here looking at, for example, your book, Spiritual Telepathy, and I'm thinking, we know nothing. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Tell me a little bit about this process, and you know, you just mentioned it just as we went into the break about how do we know that this stuff is true. That was one of the things that I've discussed with people on this program, guests who we get into discussions of different biblical passages, and I've talked with rabbis who say that the problem that people are having, especially with the Old Testament and the laws in Leviticus, is that they don't understand the context in which these laws were written, why they were put in place, and that in our modern day, they've taken those laws and they just twist them around to fit, you know, whatever they want. So talk to us. Can you talk to us a little bit about that process that you went through to, I'm not sure what the word I want to use. I want to say ferret out. truth from fiction, or, you know, how did you grapple with that aspect of, well, I want to put this in there, but, you know, people will say, well, how do you know that's true kind of thing, and so on and so forth?
Well, that's a great question. What I did was that I didn't put anything in the book that I couldn't validate in some way. Like, for example, there's this teaching on instinctive telepathy and how it's, you know, related to the solar plexus. So I looked to see if there was any other way to validate it. And boom, I found all those different cultures that I mentioned. I found Rupert Sheldrake's scientific experiments and so on. So there I thought, that's going to be hard to dispute. If all these different cultures are talking about it, if all these scientific experiments say the same thing. So I kind of used that as my benchmark, that I had to find other ways to validate. And I talk about an ancient type of mind training in this book and give specific meditations to do this. And so I thought, okay, where is this? And what I found is that it was everywhere, that this particular type of meditation was taught in the mystery schools, and it was first put into book form by Patanjali many centuries ago, the Hindu sage, in his book, The Yoga Sutras. And it's the same type of mind training that allows you to make contact with the soul. And so then I started looking at other traditions and found that it's very essential to Buddhism, that it's even mentioned in the Bible. There's one line that, let the mind be in you that's in Christ Jesus. Mm-hmm. But then I started to read the Gnostic Gospels and found that it was much more explicit there. And it's in the Kabbalah. It's in every tradition. So they're all, again, saying the same thing, that there's a way to train yourself to make this connection with the soul. It's an inner process. And then there's a certain point on the path of return, so to speak, when we go inward and we feel motivated to do this work, that our attention is no longer really focused just on the outside, but a balance between the outer and inner. And we want to have that experience.
What has changed in your life through this process of not only the research that's come, that has brought us spiritual telepathy, the book here, but in terms of where you see yourself going down the road? What are some of the maybe subtle changes that you've experienced, that you're aware of in your life?
You know, I'm really glad that you asked that question. I was just thinking about that this morning, about how this process is very subtle and how it's like upgrading your operating system, like from Mountain Lion to Sierra, to use a Mac analogy.
Okay.
But here's what happens. When you do this meditation, and it's a daily practice, you make contact with the soul, and you have, the end of the meditation, you ask that soul light pour down over your mental, emotional, and physical bodies. And it's that daily contact with the light of the soul that raises our vibration, and I think speeds up our evolution. And again, it's a very subtle energetic process. But what I've noticed over time is that I've started to look at things from a higher perspective, that I'm more in my heart, that I'm more tolerant and less judgmental, and I have a lot more joy in my life. And it's really changed how I interact with the world. And because of that, it changes what I attract. And I also noticed that I have things that come to me more easily. My life has been sort of an exercise in the power of the will. If I wanted mm-hmm. something, I just would devote all my time and attention and focus to making it happen. And it was kind of exhausting, you know, because it was just pure force of will that would get me from point A to point B. And I learned to sort of climb the publishing ladder as I learned more and more. But it was always this force of will. And so what I've noticed now is that things come to me more easily. I don't have to gear up in that same way. Like, for example, when I was just about finished with the book, I was contacted by someone and given an opportunity that just dropped right into my lap. That was the perfect time with the perfect people. And I thought, wow, I didn't do anything to make that happen. It just sort of came to me. And so that's what I've noticed, is that you get into this higher flow where what you need just comes and you don't have to stress as much. And that's been a huge relief to me.
In my career, I have found, and I've used this phrase many times, that I've been in the right place at the right time. I did have one year where I was laid off from four jobs, which was, you know, frustrating. But, you know, it's like, well, I got the first one. Then I was laid off from it. I got the second one. I was laid off from it. And those two times I went to the unemployment office, filled out the paperwork. But within 2 weeks, which is how long you have to wait before you get your first check, I had a new job. So I got no check. So the third and fourth times I was laid off, I didn't even bother going to the unemployment office. I just kept looking for work, and, you know, and it came. And then one thing led to another, and that's how we wound up here in Santa Barbara, for example. I lost my job because the station I was working for was purchased, ironically, by a Christian consortium who lied to the press when they said, oh, no, we're not going to change the format because they're profitable. They're making money, which we were. But I also knew from my Christian broadcasting experience that Christians don't like to be unequally yoked to non-believers. So I knew they were going to change the format. I just didn't know when. So on the 28th of February, I was cleaning out my desk. And then on the 1st of March, my wife calls me at her new job saying, I just quit. And I'm going, what? And in my head, I'm screaming, do you know that I'm unemployed too? But it opened up an opportunity for us to take a week-long trip to Santa Barbara. And then we got back home, put the house up for sale. And within 2 months, you know, we were driving across country with in our caravan of cars and animals. And the next thing you know, we're pulling into the place that that we've been at for over 11 years. And then when I got here, in terms of looking for work, you know, again, one thing led to another. And you're right. When you're not pressing, this word was used to describe my perspective on finding a mate, if you will, or a partner. You know, I was looking for a girlfriend, what have you. And they said, yeah, but you're coming off desperate. You got to stop being, you know, because they, you know, so to speak, they smell that coming a mile away. Same thing with everything else. It's kind of like what you were talking about, you know. Desperation does not help. It's like you literally have to put it out there and then let it go. And things just happen.
That's right.
Yeah. So what's on the horizon for humanity? I mean, is there a pinnacle? I mean, I kind of feel like we're going to discover all the things we're going to discover through all the esoteric and ancient wisdom teachings and over the next, I don't know, 50, 100, maybe 1,000 years if we don't destroy ourselves in the process. Is living in the body going to maybe go by the wayside in, you know, maybe a dozen generations or so? Do you think we'll evolve to that level where, hey, you know, we don't even need the body?
Some of us will. I don't know how long it'll take. I mean, that's sort of the ultimate, that we are pure spirit, that we go down into the physical world of time and space, and that we learn lifetime by lifetime how to return to that space with our full wisdom and understanding.
Now, you seem to be one who does believe in past lives, reincarnation.
Right, I do.
Okay. Does it matter to you who you were in past lives as much as the experiences and the things that you learned then? And it sounds to me like you've had some experience with learning about those experiences and what they teach you about who you are today.
Absolutely. I think that we come in at the level where we left off. So it's just a step-by-step process. And I think that's why some people are really starting to move to this more subtle level, and some people are not. I mean, we're all walking down the same road. We're just walking down different sections of it.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever heard of the book The Impersonal Life by James Bannon?
I haven't.
1933, I believe, is when it first came out. It was, of course, channeled. And it is, in essence, the divine talking to the reader and basically saying, you know, the thoughts that you have, you think are your thoughts. They're not. They're mine. And I am just helping you. And one of the things I read in regards to reincarnation was the fact that the book says that you seem to believe that you have lived many lifetimes, and yet I am the creator of all the lives, all of the beings, all of the expressions of myself down through history, and that all you're doing is tapping into those lifetimes. And I thought, okay, I could buy that too, but it doesn't change a thing. All it does is then says, oh, geez, I could tap into any of the other existences of humans to learn lessons that I need to learn in this lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that, I just find it fascinating. Again, all of these different perspectives.
Well, I think we have access to all our lives, past, present, and future, at a certain level, and that's beyond where we are now. But one thing that was interesting to me and very exciting to me, and one of the things that kept me going through these years of sitting and reading and exploring this material, is that there's a process, there's a step-by-step training that allows us to make direct contact, that we don't have to put around in our garden planting bulbs and hope that it'll strike us, that it can happen spontaneously, but that we can actually train ourselves to make that contact at will. So we have this steady source of guidance that we can go to at any point. And again, this type of training was once taught only to initiates in the mystery schools, and they only let a select few in. And now we're evolved enough that any of us can do it if we're willing to take on the discipline. It is a daily practice, and the daily aspect of it is very important. Because what we're doing when we're doing this basic meditation, we're extending our attention upward to the soul day after day. And basically, we're creating small threads of energy that over time create a symbolic bridge that gives us a direct connection to that higher level. And it's a subtle process. And I've noticed too from studying this is that this idea of a bridge between the higher and lower worlds can also be found everywhere. In the wisdom teachings, it's called the rainbow bridge or the bridge of light. In the Hindu text, it's called the Antakarana. And I even found it in the Bible. It's called the straight or narrow gate in the New Testament. Mm-hmm. I read the New Testament for the first time when I was studying this material.
Oh, wow.
And I was very excited at all this sort of esoteric undertones that if you looked a little deeper, that there's a deeper meaning. You know, there's sort of the literal meaning and then there's deeper meaning and that you could really see it come alive. And I had studied the esoteric literature first, which sort of primed me for that. But I was never told to read the Bible when I was a kid. It was like the priests were the intermediaries and, you know, you focused on them. You didn't go directly to God and try to learn his word through the Bible.
Well, you were being a good Catholic.
That's right. I'd never read it.
You know, I had a great opportunity of interviewing. I think I interviewed him twice back when I was working there at the Christian station. His name was John Noe. He wrote a book called The Apocalypse Conspiracy. It kind of goes to what you're talking about a little bit. And he was upset over the fact that he felt like Christianity, Christendom, had been taken down a primrose path, that they'd been lied to by the powers that be and so forth. And so he began to do his own research. And what he did was, and you kind of have to take this at face value, he said, okay, I have my concordance, and I'm accepting that it's accurate, and I have my Bible. And I'm accepting, for the sake of argument, that it's accurate. And one passage in particular that I researched myself, I put my two books side by side, and it was what they refer to as the rapture passage, where, you know, they will be caught up to meet him in the air in the clouds of glory. Okay? And what he did was he went to the concordance and he found the word air in that passage. And in the New Testament, there were two definitions of the word air. There was the atmosphere, the clouds and the planes fly through it and the birds and so on and so forth. And then the other one was equivalent to that God breathed the breath of life into the nostrils of Adam. And it was the second definition of the word air in that passage. They will be caught up to meet him in the clouds, in the air, in the clouds of glory. And that, along with a lot of other research that he did, said to him, and that he wanted to share with everyone else, that the spiritual aspects of Christianity are exclusively an internal process. There's nothing external about it. Now, things will manifest externally, but being a Christian, as he perceived it, was an internal. It all took place on the inside. Second coming, there is no second, number two, of the Christ.
That's so interesting because the second coming is seen as, you know, this this time when Jesus descends on the earth again.
Yeah.
But really, it happens when our hearts open,
We're
open to each other.
Yes. Yes. That's what he said. He said that it never says second. It says he will return. But it doesn't say how many times.
Right.
And
right.
we could have him return in, you know, the Christ return to us. Multiple times in the day, in the week, in the month, in the year. And that was one of the things that really struck me about his book in particular. And I share this quite often on the program. And that goes to the aspect of, yes, he calls himself an evangelical fundamentalist Christian. He's Bible believing. And yet he puts out this book that says, yes, this is what the Bible says, but it's not interpreted. And the same thing goes holds true when I've interviewed rabbis, and I'm working on having some imams on, but I've done some reading about the Quran. that talks about the ebb and flow throughout the Quran, moving from the literal to the metaphorical to the spiritual, back and forth through all of these things. And unless you know the context in which these passages were placed, you know, you take them literally, and that's the first mistake that we make.
That's right. The Christ returns when the Christ principle blooms in our hearts, our open hearts. And so again, it's, you can take it literally as he descends on earth, or you can take it that the love that he showed everyone blooms in us.
Yeah. There's a wonderful little poem. The author's name, I want to say Sebastian Tiberius. I think that was his name. And I'll just paraphrase very quickly. And that was that the gods were upset over the fact that man was starting to become aware of who and what he really is as a spiritual being, and that, in essence, they felt threatened. They said, we need to hide this information from man, or we're going to be in trouble. We're going to be out of a job. So they debated as to where to hide it. Oh, we'll hide it on the mountaintops. No, he'll find a way to climb it. We'll hide in the ocean. No, he'll find a way to dive deep there. We'll hide it here and there and here and there. And finally, one of them says, wait a minute. I know where we'll hide it. We'll hide it in his heart. He'll never look there.
Right, right.
Tell me about the heart as in that symbology, if you will, in reference to our spiritual life as you see it.
Well, I have a whole section on the heart, and the reason is that it's really essential. It's said in these teachings that we progressed as a species from the first chakra to the second to the third, and most of humanity is still polarized in the third. And that the next step is the heart. And I think that's why there's so much focus on the heart now with the work of heart math and related subjects, is that's when we start to open to the universal nature of man, that the heart really is the borderline. It's the borderline between the three physical chakras below and the spiritual chakras above. That we start to become real spiritual beings when we start to open the heart. And we can't really do this higher type of spiritual telepathy until the heart's open, until we're starting to access those higher chakras.
How does all of this relate to, say, our physical bodily health and well-being?
Well, I think it relates in many ways. One thing, when we do this work, there's a period of refinement, and I devoted a whole chapter to that. And the reason that we refine the physical, emotional, and mental bodies is so that we're ready for the influx of this higher energy. And this is part of all spiritual traditions. And the requirements and the goals are exactly the same, even though they do it in different ways. And it's purity of body, control of the emotions, and stability of mind. And this can be seen in the Noble Eightfold Path of the Buddha, the development of Christian virtues, and the teachings on character refinement in Judaism and Islam, that we have to be quiet inside to be able to perceive this higher level of thought. And if we don't, our especially emotional static will really kind of repel the subtle currents of thought so they don't reach the brain. And again, the information has to reach the brain before we have conscious awareness of it. So we learn how to purify our bodies, to eat right, to give ourselves adequate sleep and exercise, and we learn how to quiet ourselves down. And there's practices that I give in the book that have helped me the most, harmlessness and the nightly review, and especially the meditations on loving kindness, forgiveness, and compassion. I interviewed a lot of people that practice these meditations, and I asked them all, what did you do to refine the emotional body? And the number one thing everyone said was forgiveness. And I thought that was really interesting, because when I started this, I was really upset about something and really having trouble forgiving someone. It's easy to forgive somebody if you can sit down and talk things out. It's harder when you can't, and you know, the other person tells you that you're the problem. And I had such a hard time with it. And when I sat down to meditate, all I could think about was how mad I was at this person. And so I started working with a spiritual healer named Stephen Lumiere. And his prescription, so to speak, for me was three meditations: loving kindness, forgiveness, and compassion. And he told me to do these three times a day, morning, noon, and night. And so I did. And over a period of time, I started to calm down. I was able to forgive this person, regardless of whether or not the problems that we had could ever be resolved. I just forgave her. And I started to quiet down. And it was really that at that point that I started to meditate more deeply. So we really have to get ourselves ready. The lower bodies have to be kind of a whole. They have to be quiet. The body has to be kind of, the vibration of the body has to be upgraded. And the rest of the mind, the rest of us, the mind and emotions, has to be quiet. And when that happens, then we're pure channels. Then the information can reach the brain.
I know that a lot of folks struggle with meditation. I am one of them. And I take solace from the quote from Teresa of Avila, I believe it was Teresa of Avila, who says, God is amongst the pots and the pans. Mm-hmm. And so I take solace in that as we're doing this interview, God is amongst the circuits and the lights, little flashing lights, and in the computer and all of that kind of stuff. And for me, this is my therapy, for one, but it is also an opportunity for us to exchange ideas. And it, of course, reminds me of James Redfield in his Celestine Prophecy, talking about how we all have messages for one another, and that it is incumbent upon us to share those messages. Otherwise, we deprive one another of the opportunity of, as I put it, adding new pieces to the giant puzzle that we're trying to put together, which is our life, to try to see a bigger picture. And, you know, when you don't forgive and you don't go through those processes of, you know, understanding one another, and in our day and age today, it's very difficult because of a lot of the stuff that is going on, not just in this country, but around the world. But there are people that I have on this program, yourself included, who are doing their darndest to try to show people, hey, there is another way, which is what we're trying to find, those new ways of living, to make a better world, to make a world where everybody gets to thrive. No more surviving. We're done with surviving. It's kind of like the 80s and early 90s in psychology, it was victimhood. It was my mom and dad's fault that I'm the way that I am. They did this to me. And now we're in the, I'm taking responsibility. It doesn't matter what my folks did. It's on me now. I've got to do what I've got to do. And I think that's what we're doing here today. And I thank you so much for the work that you are doing. It's needed, obviously, now more than ever. And again, we do thank you for that.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Richard Dugan, and we're talking with Colleen Morrow. She's the author of Spiritual Telepathy, Ancient Techniques to Access the Wisdom of Your Soul. Is there anything that we didn't cover that you wanted to touch upon?
Yeah, there is actually one thing. And this is something that I stumbled over accidentally. And it's the idea of genius. And I figured out where genius comes from, that it's not a rare and random event, okay, that it's something that any and all of us can experience, that once we contact the soul, as I mentioned earlier, we have the ability to extend our attention even higher and access information from the divine or universal mind, where information on all subjects can be found. And as I studied the history of these people we call geniuses, what I discovered is that they were talking about their creative process in exactly the way it's explained in the wisdom tradition, that it's through the soul that they had access to this level of information that just flowed into their brains. Composers talk about this, writers talk about this, scientists talk about this, and it occurred to me that this isn't a rare and random event. You're not special if you're a genius. You just somehow learned how to do this. And so that was exciting to me when I thought about the fact that we can all be creative geniuses and think of what we can bring into the world, the beauty and the wisdom, the new inventions, all these things that we could add to the world if we make that connection.
You make me think of Da Vinci, Bach, Beethoven, Shostakovich. You make me think of Edison and Henry Ford, and even a not-so-well-known inventor in India, Jagadish Chandra Bose, who came up with the crescograph, which allowed him to be able to, in real time, measure the effects on plants of emotion. And it was fascinating when I was reading about him in Autobiography of a Yogi about that particular thing. And I even bought I've got it in my library, a book that he wrote about some of the things that he created. And it's just and then people like Royal Raymond Rife and the Rife Frequency Generator and other people who are doing phenomenal things today, whether they're using electronics mechanical mechanisms or crystals and whatever else is out there to assist people. It's just amazing.
Well, imagine that the whole world is like that. Imagine that it's not just the gifted few that are bringing down this kind of information, that it's all of us. We can all live with a foot in both worlds, the human world and the spiritual world.
I have to say that one of my observations and one of the great tragedies of human existence is war. And not because of the conflict itself, but because of the incredible lost potential. That's what really breaks my heart, is we don't know what contribution these people would have made if they hadn't been forced to fight somebody else's battle and died in the process.
That's right.
I wish that we valued human life a little bit more than we do in that regard. I mean, it's so indiscriminate sometimes. And I mean, some of these folks, you know, you see some of their stories. And then, of course, even the violence that happens in every country that citizens do to each other or even to themselves. And we don't realize our great potential. By the way, you mentioned this whole aspect of genius and that we all have access to it. It makes me think of Jesus and all of the miracles that he performed. And then he was asked by his apostles, you know, hey, you know, you're doing all this stuff, you know, can we do that too? And he says, you're kidding me? You think you can do this too, but you guys are going to do even greater things. And I keep wondering, what the hell are they? Because I don't see it happening. Well, actually, I do, because we have people such as yourself who are doing the research. You're finding the techniques in all of the wonderful esoteric and ancient wisdom teachings, talking with people who are doing that kind of stuff. And that's what we're trying to do on this program is share that, saying, hey, it is out there. You can do it. It is possible. And you do have exercises in your book to guide people through as well.
There's 12 meditations in the book. I wanted it to be a very accessible step-by-step. And so anybody can pick it up that's attracted to the subject and start right from the beginning.
This is exciting. I'm impressed by the fact that, you know, of course you've been dealing with all of these experiences, again, as you've talked about your magazine, Intuition, and dealing with the untapped power of the mind. And I guess the final thing I'll bring up in this regard is, or to query you on in terms of the mind and its relationship to the soul in reference to this whole aspect of spirituality as well as spiritual telepathy.
Well, the mind, once trained, becomes the tool. It becomes like a telescope. It's what we use to access the higher worlds. And that's why this basic mind training, step-by-step process is so important, and why a daily discipline is important, because you learn to quiet the mind. So the mind becomes our servant rather than our master. It focuses where we want it to focus. It doesn't go where it wants to go. Mm-hmm. And we know it wants to go all over the place. So when the mind's under our control, it's a tool. And this teaching tells us that the mind is was created to work in two directions. It can work outward into the physical world and give us information that then is transmitted to the brain, and it helps us to understand our surroundings. But with training, it also can be trained to access the subtle world. So it can work outward or inward, and it's just a matter of training and a daily discipline.
I'm wondering if, because I've heard descriptions of what we're supposed to do in meditation as far as, you know, telling the mind to be quiet and stop doing the things that it's doing. I'm trying to meditate. Will you just keep it down? This is a library, okay? And I understand your description, but I'm wondering, because we want the mind to be a participant in our daily lives. You say you want to treat the mind in the context of you being used as a tool in this process. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if we were to address the mind as an individual and say, look, I want you part of the process, and I want you to be a valuable tool in this process. Can we work together on this? And in terms of collaboration rather than, and maybe it's just the word that you've chosen, controlling it.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's already jerking us around. You know, we sit down and it's like a herd of wild horses. It goes where it wants to go. And so we're taming it.
Okay.
And we're training it to go where we want it to go. And so then we have sort of a dual tool, like I said. It extends outward into the physical world, but then we have the option of using it to discover and explore the subtle worlds as well.
That's funny. I hadn't heard it quite put like that, but it's quite accurate. It is absolutely quite accurate. Well, this is, again, a lot of fun to read through, and I encourage our listeners. I mean, just I'll be honest with you. I was just taken when I take a look at, for example, the table of contents, and you've got the evolutionary journey, the universal human, the three minds, the three types of telepathy, which we've talked about as well, refining your physical, emotional, and mental bodies, building the rainbow bridge you've also discussed as well in the soul, the kingdom of God, and then becoming a world server. By the way, chapter 7, the soul of the kingdom of God, made me think of another author. He was a Catholic priest, Johannes Graeber, and he wrote a book called Communication with the Spirit World of God. But he also wrote his version of the New Testament, but it was channeled through the same entity that is in Communication with the Spirit World of God. I even remember giving the book to my mom to read once, and she read it, but she didn't like it. And at that time, she was still very much in the Catholic phase because it was rather critical of a lot of the Catholic practices and so forth. But one of the things that he said in his translation of the New Testament was that his version of seek ye first not the kingdom of God. He says, seek ye first communication with the spirit world, and all these things will be added unto you. And
well,
I think
the kingdom of God really is that soul realm.
Yeah.
And so when Jesus said, seek ye first the kingdom of God, that is actually the first step, because that puts us in touch with the spiritual world. That's the soul is the portal.
Mm. I also think, too, of the biblical passage of casting your bread upon the water. Makes me think of the concepts contained within The Secret, the book and the movie. And I remember somebody was sharing with me in one of these programs about how they left the part out. The part they left out, and it was intentional, maybe it wasn't, and I'm not casting aspersions. What they left out was that you don't know whether or not what you want to connect with is not only for your highest good, but is part of your life's purpose. And it's just something that your mind, your ego says, I want it because I want it, kind of thing. Like a little kid might say, it's mine, I want it. And that was part of what they talked about. And it's like, you know, if you want that, that's fine, but it could do you more harm than good. And at some point, the universe will say, you know what, you've been badgering me for months. Here, you can have it. And, you know, you're going to have to deal with the fallout. What your thoughts on I'll use the term law of attraction, but that principle.
Well, again, as I said, when you start to develop these higher mental capacities, you start to develop a higher flow. So what you want just comes to you more easily. That's my experience, is that I don't have to use my will. I don't have to use all my focus, which is pretty exhausting, to try to get something that comes to me.
Very interesting. Thank you. Colleen, I want to thank you, of course, for the time that you've shared with us here on the program. And I would like to, first of all, invite our listeners to go to your website, which is spiritualtelepathy.net. That's spiritualtelepathy.net. And then second of all, I would like to invite you, should you find yourself here in the Santa Barbara area, to come in studio so we can continue this conversation. This is fascinating.
That would be fun. I'd love to do that.
And before we let you go, I have three final questions for you, if you don't mind. Mm-hmm. You've probably answered them in some fashion throughout the program, but I'm going to ask them directly to you. There is no right or wrong answer. There's no dualism in the responses to these questions. First of all, who is Colleen Morrow?
Well, I'd say what we talked about before, a spiritual being having a human experience, just like everybody else.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
I would like to have people have the kind of experience that I've had, this opening and this ability to access directly the soul and the guidance that you can get.
And finally, what is your life's purpose?
I think to communicate this kind of information.
Colleen Morrow, Spiritual Telepathy, Ancient Techniques to Access the Wisdom of Your Soul. SpiritualTelepathy.net is the website. Again, thank you so much for joining us here on the program.
I enjoyed your questions.
I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love to Lal.